I just cleared through security. I tend to get a little more stressed because I hate flying so much that my OCD kicks into high gear and basically tells me that if I do certain things, I can control bad things from happening. It's a little bathroom routine that I end up doing. I have to end up doing this thing where I'm counting how many pumps of the soap. And I have to do 5, 5, 5, 5, 5. To 25, then go with my hands, 5, 5, 5, 5, 5, 25. Basically, I just have to keep doing these 5 counts. And if you don't, something bad's gonna happen. So, I just keep doing it. Until finally it just says, I've done enough, and then I can go. So, yeah. Welcome to Now or Never. I'm Trevor Dineen. And that person you just heard in the bathroom going through that whole routine of soap and hand washing, that was me. I have obsessive compulsive disorder, or OCD as a lot of people like to call it, and it's something I've had since I was 21 years old. And I can honestly say, beyond a shadow of a doubt, it has been the hardest thing I've ever had to deal with in my entire life. I've never really talked about it publicly. I've talked about my friends and my family, but it's not something I really shared on air. And I really wanted to do this episode because I wanted to really shine a light on how absolutely terrifying and hard OCD can be. Because for me, it almost took my life. Now, I'm one of the lucky ones. I got to find therapy. I got treatment. It worked. And today I mostly have it under control, but to be honest, I will always have compulsions that come and go in my life. They'll never fully go away. And when stress and anxiety flares up in me, and unfortunately for me, I have such a fear of flying that the compulsions come back every single time I go into an airport. So today I'm flying across the country because I want to meet other people that have OCD in various stages, doing whatever it takes to manage and live with this illness.
Kind of promised myself that one day if I did have some success and that I did get better, you know, I'd played in the NHL, I'd coached in the NHL, that I would put my story out there. And that's kind of what happened, that I was just ready to do it. And it had been long enough.
This will probably shock people, but if I could choose between my child having cancer or mental illness, I would pick cancer hands down. Hands down.
Not, you know, eating your Smarties from red to yellow in that order every time, or like Monk on TV. It's a lot of things that are a lot smaller and a lot more insidious, and it's not a joke.
I'm Ifi Chiwetalu, and you are about to hear a very different sounding episode of Now or Never with people fighting and living with mental illness. If you or someone you know needs support, we have a list of resources on our website. Also, the 211 helpline is active in all provinces, so if you need someone to talk to, that's a great place to start. Also on this episode, you're going to hear a very different side of you,
yeah.
Trevor Dineen.
On this episode, I'll be talking to a lot of people that were closest to me back then. I'm talking to my parents. I've never asked them what it was like from their perspective, so I'm going to find out what that is like. And I'm also going to be talking to the guy who I will say saved my life. And there's something I've been wanting to tell him for a good 10 years now, and I think I'm going to get the chance to do it on this episode.
This is such a big and vulnerable thing for you.
Yeah, it's a very personal episode to me, so stick around. This is Now or Never, talking about OCD.
You've mentioned before, Trevor, that you have compulsion still. And hearing you in the bathroom, I think I really felt like I was there with you. And it was surprising a little bit to hear what that sounded like. And I know that's you now. And it used to be a lot worse. Mm-hmm. How bad did it get?
It was pretty awful, honestly. When at the height of it, it would take me an hour and 15 minutes to leave a bathroom. It would take me an hour and 20 minutes to get into bed, another hour to get out of bed. I had so many routines. I had up to like 200 to 300 different routines that would take away about 4 to 5 hours of my day just doing these routines. And I just pulled away from everyone in my life. I dropped out of school. I dropped out of my job. I pulled away from all my friends. And the breaking point came on Christmas Eve when I was 22 years old. I remember everyone coming to my house, all the family, and everyone was coming inside and they were all putting their presents down and everyone was coming around for a dinner. And my aunt said to me, "Oh, Trevor, we forgot some presents in the car. Do you mind going to grab them?" I made like a bunch of excuses, but they were just like, "No, just go get them." They didn't know any better. So I finally just went outside, knowing full well what was about to happen. And sure enough, in the middle of the winter, here I am just doing circles around their car. And it's not just their car. There's like 4 cars in the driveway. And my routine was I had to do circles around all the cars, touching all the locks, the trunk, the bumper, and just going around. And I had to do it like 25 times. So I'm circling one car 25 times, go to the next car, circle that car, 4 cars. And then I walk up to the house, opening and closing the door 25 times, doing the thing with the closet, going and flicking a light switch, and there's just silence behind me. There's no noise, and I can just feel everyone looking at me. I didn't turn around once. And then I just put the bag on the ground, and I walked downstairs in my basement, and I completely broke down. Because at that point, it had been like a good year and a half of just progressively getting worse. I realized I couldn't stop myself from doing any of that with a room full of people looking at me. There is no hope for me at all. I don't think I've ever been so scared in my entire life.
Was your family aware of how bad it was before that moment?
Well, I think they were getting to realize how bad it was, but then I asked my mom what she saw that night.
I remember how difficult it was, to see you, to see what was happening to you. We watched you go from this teenager that seemed to have everything to this young man who was falling apart and we couldn't do anything about. We watched this slow transformation of this counting issues and having to turn off and on light switches and walk around things umpteen times. And it was just, it was devastating. As a parent, you know, you will do anything. So we sought out to try and find answers for you.
So after that, my parents took it upon themselves to find me help. I'd never even knew where to look before. And they looked everywhere and we tried so many different things, but luckily I found a doctor who helped save my life. I'm really excited to talk to him later in the show. I want you to meet someone. Her name is Ev. She's 18 years old and heading to university soon, and she's one of the patients treated at the OCD clinic at the BC Children's Hospital. Now, if you're wondering what it's like on the inside of treatment and inside the head of someone who has OCD, she can tell you. Now, just a warning, her OCD shows up as intrusive thoughts about harming herself, and she goes into quite a bit of detail.
It's like if you were walking down the street and you came to a busy intersection. I know, think, just for example, in Vancouver, we've got Knight Street, and that's the trucking route. So there are all these big semis going by, you know, 100 miles an hour. I'm sure there's a street like that in every city. And you're crossing it on foot, and the second you get to the intersection, the only thing you can think of is stepping into traffic. And you are not suicidal. It's just the only thing your brain will give you. And you're standing on the edge of the intersection, and all you can think about is the way it would feel to be hit by something weighing 100 or more times your body weight going at 100 miles an hour, you know, truck versus person, who would win? And you think about what it would feel like to hit the pavement and be dragged underneath the tires, and who would be watching, and who would find you, and who would call 911, but who would call your family, and how would they find out? And then before you know it, you've been standing at the same intersection for 10 minutes, and maybe you're crying because this is upsetting, or maybe you're so used to this happening all the time that you're kind of desensitized to it, and then you finally just have to force yourself to cross the street, because if you avoid everything that's going to cause these kinds of thoughts to come up, you're not going to be able to have a life. And I guess a big part of people who have OCD, that people who don't understand, is that it's not all, you know, washing your hands over and over and over, although that does come up, and it's not, you know, eating your Smarties from red to yellow in that order every time, or like Monk on TV. It's a lot of things that are a lot smaller and a lot more insidious, and it's not a joke. It's like real, actual horror that people are experiencing. My earliest memories of noticing what you would consider facets of obsessive compulsive disorder are probably around age 5 or 6. I used to line up my stuffed animals in a certain order every night before I went to bed, and then I would kiss them all, and then again, and then again, and without doing this I couldn't go to sleep. And the memories get a lot more detailed from there, but that's probably the earliest memory I have of doing something that would be considered a compulsion. More than 10 years later, when I was 16, I stopped being able to do homework, which was pretty detrimental to my education. So I very begrudgingly took myself to a psychiatrist. It was a youth clinic, thanks Canada. And I sat down and said, can I please have a psychiatric assessment? And they said, why? And I said, I just, please, like, if you can do that, that would mean a lot to me. So they did. And it's a longer story than this, but eventually they're like, yeah, you have severe obsessive compulsive disorder. And that was the first time anyone had ever said that to me. I didn't believe them. And then it took a couple months of working with the clinician to actually believe that it wasn't normal, and that what I was going through and what I had been going through wasn't something that everybody my age experienced. Once I finally agreed to humor them, it made a lot of things about my life make a lot more sense. I realized that it wasn't normal to be afraid all the time, and that everybody has fears and everybody experiences anxiety, but to be afraid for your life and the life of your family and friends and feel that guilt and culpability like every moment of every day wasn't something that everybody else was also experiencing. So a psychologist and I developed what we called intrusive thoughts Candyland. And Candyland is, you know, the classic children's board game, sweet related. You try and make your way around the board using the different colors. But what we did, we would put post-it notes over them, and the post-it notes would say something like, hold a pair of scissors over your fingers. And then you, if you landed on that space, you would do what it said. So, you know, you'd take the scissors her secretary had in the office and just hold them over your fingers. And for someone with OCD who experiences intrusive thoughts surrounding harm to themselves or others, like I have, then you just sit with the knowledge that it wouldn't be that hard to just press down and cut your pinky finger off. You could do it. It'd be relatively easy. but you're obviously not going to, and the purpose of the exercise is to make the thought seem less scary and less of a real possibility and to just make it seem absurd and irrelevant. So I'd land on that space, and then you just hold the scissors around your fingers for 5 minutes. We just sit there in silence. And then eventually, the next time you land on it, she would make me have a conversation with her, and you have to learn to just keep going about your life while experiencing these thoughts, and then eventually they're so inconsequential that you don't experience them anymore. I move away to university in August, and doctors love to tell me that you often experience a resurgence in OCD symptoms and thoughts when you're undergoing big change and stress in your life and something like moving across the country away from everybody you've ever known is definitely a big change and it's definitely stressful. So I'm just preparing to deal with that and to combat any challenges related to OCD as they come up. I want to be a psychiatrist, and I want to specialize in OCD in children and adolescents because the psychiatrists that I've worked with have changed my life, and I want to be able to do that for kids who are like me and tell them that I was where you were and it does change and it can get better and you don't have to live your whole life like this because you can take steps not to fix your brain but to change the way you think. And I get to carry around a stethoscope, which is also very cool.
What she did was exposure therapy, which is a form of cognitive behavioral therapy. That's what I did. It was a form of treatment that worked for me after trying many other forms of treatment before that. My doctor was kind enough to give me a list of different resources that people can go to look at and check out about OCD and mental health. So if you are going through something, or if a family member or a friend is going through something and you want to learn more, go to our website. It's at cbc.ca/now or never. You may know Corey Hirsch as an NHL goaltender, but here's something you might not know. For years, he lived with debilitating OCD. He had panic attacks, obsessive thoughts, throughout much of his NHL career. Now, it got so bad, he came within 15 seconds and a few short meters from ending his own life while driving toward a cliff. It took decades, but he finally went public about the hell that OCD trapped him in, so I decided to ask him why it took so long and why he chose now.
When I was laying in my bed sick and you know, looking for any signs of somebody that was successful, I scoured through bookstores, everything, looking for some sign of hope, and I found nothing. And actually, I had met a player that was in rehab about 8 months ago. I decided to just take him out for coffee, and he was an NHL player. He was in the prime of his career when this stuff derailed him, and I didn't know what was wrong with him. I had no idea, but I was like, you know what? I'm going to make him feel not alone, and I'm just going to spew out my story to him. And I spewed out my story, and he looked at me like a deer in the headlights, and he said, "Oh my God, I have never told anybody other than my therapist, but that is exactly what happened to me." So, wow. And I just went, whoa, that was kind of one of the first times I had met somebody with OCD. But at that moment, it made me realize, you know what, there are a lot more people out there that need help, that need to hear my story. And this was a guy thankfully I didn't have any addiction issues. Most people do that have these types of problems. So that was, you know, one of those aha moments that Oprah talks about. That was one of them for me, was like, I got to get my story out there.
Corey and I had such a compelling conversation. To be honest, it felt like I'd really known him for a very, very long time. He talks about the first terrifying intrusive thought he ever had, the downward spiral it dragged his life into, and the lengths he went to hide it from his teammates and his coaches. It's a conversation that I really want you to hear in full, so please go to our website at cbc.ca/now or never, because it's very interesting to hear someone who was once a professional athlete at the top of his career dealing with something so secretive and so hidden. The quickest answer of a door I've ever seen.
Oh, I saw you walking up.
This is the O'Connor family. I flew all the way to Victoria just to meet them.
Okay. This is Kylie.
Hi.
Kylie, hi, I'm Trevor.
Hi, nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you too. Their daughter Kylie, she's only 14 years old, and she's in the middle of a very severe struggle with OCD, which I found out is only one of the major struggles facing their family. So I sat down with Kylie, her mom Lisa, and her stepdad Jay, to find out what it's like to deal with OCD from such a young age. Do you remember the very first compulsion? Do you remember when it started at all? Your finger went up very fast.
Sort of. So I remember I was sitting in the car, and I remember the exact moment we were outside of the grocery store and we were going out of the parking lot, and I was like, Mom, do you ever feel like if you don't do something, something really bad's going to happen? She's like, what do you mean? And I was like, do you ever feel like if you don't, like, shut the door 30 times and then open it and then shut it again, that, like, the fire, that, like, the house will, like, burst up into flames and stuff? I was probably, like, 6 at the time, mm-hmm. or 7 maybe. And she's like, no, I don't. And I just felt so alone because I was like, oh, my God, it's just me.
Do you remember that, when she said that? Whether the house would burn into flames?
There's been many talk about, you don't feel that, you know, if you don't double check something that, you know, like a burglar's going to come in and stab you? Or something, like all these, like there's been a ton of them. And I'm like, I don't feel that way. I don't know what that is mm-hmm. necessarily. But it was right around the time that she got diagnosed. So we knew very well it was obsessive compulsive disorder. It was an obsessive thinking and then obsessions to relieve the thought process in order to then calm the body down temporarily.
So, you know, like turning off the light switch like 30 times, turning it off 30 times. And then, you know, calling my mom from school, like, is my light off? Is my light off? Or, like, you know, when we were, walking down the hall in class, I'd be, like, tapping things, and I could tell that people were noticing.
From the age of 2, actually, I knew something was not right, because she would scream for hours on end, multiple times a day. It was grueling. It was so hard to see that in your child, and you knew that it wasn't, like, a temper tantrum, mm-hmm. and then she turned 3, and then 4, and then 5, and it continued. This type of behavior continued, and it wasn't until she was 7 that my husband and I went to a counselor, because we just thought, oh, we were at a loss about, this was very explosive type behavior, and we just didn't know what to do about it. And this counselor had said, do you think maybe your daughter has, like, a diagnosis of some sort? Like, I don't know. And I go, what do you mean? And he said, well, like, mental illness or something. And I'm like, no. Mm-hmm. But it turned out that, yeah, we took her to a therapist, and within 10 minutes she said she has severe OCD. And then we had to take her to the pediatrician to confirm it, and it was confirmed at that time. And she was just this, my precious little girl, just struggling, like just talking to this pediatrician saying, like, help me. I have all these bad thoughts and I don't know what to do. And I just, you know, at age 7, was very early on that it was so uncomfortable for her to be in her own skin, mm-hmm. that she didn't even want to be here at 7.
Was getting a diagnosis a relief in some way to know what it was?
In the very beginning, yes.
I feel like there's a but.
But it's useless, right? It feels useless because, you know, even with the diagnosis, and then she'll get another diagnosis and then another diagnosis. And it's just, it's the treatment we care about, right? Mm-hmm. So get the treatment and treat the cause, treat the disease. And then there'll be some excitement.
The treatment that Kylie has received, unfortunately, hasn't worked. And the referrals she's gotten to new doctors the demand is so high that they aren't even accepting new patients. And here's the thing. Kylie isn't the only member of the family in the middle of a battle right now. The O'Connors have another daughter, Kira, who is 16 years old. Last year, she was diagnosed with a rare form of Hodgkin's lymphoma. In fact, this week, she was heading into radiation. You have one battling a disease of the body, mm-hmm. one battling one with the mind. Mm-hmm. How do you kind of cope between those two?
Oh, I don't know. I just keep going every day. They both have different treatments. They both have different things that they're doing. But the most upsetting part is really there's only help for one. Like, and it's like, it's a constant fight. I have to fight every day talking to people at, you know, this center or that center or this therapist and like trying to get her the help that she needs. And then, but for my other daughter, you just go, you go to the meeting and then they give you a call and they say, you be here on this date and she's going to have this radiation set up. We're going to do surgery and do this. And then we're going to, on this date for 4 weeks, we're going to do this. And it's sorted out. You know, it's like, I don't have to do anything for her treatment. But when it comes to mental illness, I feel like I have to be, I'm the one doing the treatment, mm-hmm. you know, or at least busting my butt to try to get her the help she needs. And it's like you go in circles and you hit roadblock after roadblock after roadblock. And like even there is, I think, one therapist in Victoria that does proper DBT.
What's DBT?
Dialectical Behavioral Emotional Therapy of some sort. I actually don't know what it stands for. And she, I've called her too, and there's a wait list. She's not accepting patients. You know, we just don't have the resources and the facilities in BC. I don't know about the rest of the provinces, but.
I feel like having that constant reminder every day that your other daughter's getting help so easily and it's there. Mm-hmm. That's just got to be even more frustrating because it's a daily reminder of it.
It is a daily reminder, and it's, you know, for people to say that mental illness is not a life-threatening disease like cancer, it's just simply not true. It's simply not true. I mean, and then you think, okay, let's get rid of the stigma against mental health, and they're really trying to push for that, but then you do, and then there is no help. Mm-hmm. You know, like, this will probably shock people, but if I could choose between my child having cancer or mental illness, I would pick cancer hands down, because first of all, there's treatment. Mm-hmm. They can keep them alive, right? And then second of all, there's opportunity. You know how much my other daughter has been able to do since she's had cancer? Right now, she's on a white water rafting trip in Whistler with the oncology kids. She just got back from a dog sledding expedition in Quebec for 8 days with tip of your toes with the oncology kids. She's met the Canucks. We've been to concerts. Like, she gets a wish. We're going to Fiji in August, you know, because she has cancer. And then there's Kylie, that just continues to suffer. And it's, as parents, it is the hardest thing. It's the hardest thing, first of all, that your kids are sick, but second, that you can't help one. You can't help one.
How does that feel for you? Like, when you hear all that and you see your sister, who you probably love dearly, I'm guessing, but when you see that and your sister's getting all this, how does that make you feel when you're watching that?
Well, I've always been really, like, guilt-ridden. Yeah, it's hard. And it sucks that she has cancer. And I love my sister. She's my best friend. But it is hard. You know, I'm having a bunch of people come up to me and they say stuff like, you know, oh, tell your sister to get better. And your sister is the most beautiful girl I've ever met. Tell her I'm sorry, all this stuff. And I'm sitting there and I'm like, you know I have OCD and you never once said any like thing like that to me. So it's hard, but I mean, I'm glad that she's getting help, mm-hmm. but it just sucks that I'm not.
6 weeks ago, she was admitted into an inpatient facility. When I came to visit, she'd only been home for about 2 days. Her family's happy to have her home, but they're still struggling to find the right treatment for her. Like, honestly, is there any questions that anyone has for me as someone who's gone through this and continues to go through it?
So what help did you get and where did you get your help?
For myself, we tried a bunch of different therapy. My mother is the one that actually led the charge on that. She was like, I need to get you help. And so we did a bunch of different therapists. We tried one who told me to rub a rock. And if I rubbed the rock for long enough, that, and I thought of all my compulsions, they would slowly go away. Yeah. And I left there being like, this is the worst therapy of all time. Like, what is this? This is garbage. And then I went to a woman's house that my mom found who had OCD. And I went there, and then she showed me all the compulsions she does. And I left there feeling even worse. And so,
you wanted to do those compulsions?
Yes, and then all of a sudden they transferred over a bit too, because that's what happens. All of a sudden you see someone else's compulsions, yeah, and all of a sudden they pick up in your brain, and then you start doing them as well. And it's the way you're... Yeah. Sorry, you understand what I'm talking about, right?
Totally, yeah, I get that.
And then next thing you know, my mother found Dr. Jim Willows, and he was a psychiatrist out of Seven Oaks Hospital in Winnipeg, and he had a background in OCD and some other things. And she just kept calling and was able to get me in. And there was a wait list, and I was able to get bumped to the front of it. And we had our first session, and we sat down, and he asked me to write out and talk to him about all my compulsions. And we did cognitive behavioral therapy. And after 4.5 months, I was able to walk out of there, and I got to live my life again. A long answer to where I got my help.
So it sounds like there was no one telling you what you needed to do, or no one could describe to you how to get help. Mm-hmm. Your mother had to be the advocate, mm-hmm, and keep pushing and pushing. So you have to find that right person, that right place, that right institution to get to get help.
I think that would be my lesson I learned from that, is just keep going. If one doesn't work and another doesn't work, you're eventually going to find one that works. What would you want to say to your daughter who's sitting right over there? If you had to say something to her right now to kind of sum up how you feel.
So Kylie, with having OCD, always feels that things are like messy or dirty, right? It's never good enough, right? Things are stained or things are whatever. So she always has a hard time people coming here, like friends or professionals or whoever it may be. But she feels she has to like put it in gear and dust and sweep and mop and do everything. And she gets really heightened about like people are coming to this house and it's disgusting. So I want to say, I'm so proud of you, Kylie, because these two lovely people are here today and you did not pick up one thing. You did not pull the vacuum out. You did not pull the broom out. You didn't even mention how disgusting things look to you and that you were embarrassed people coming. So I feel that you did get over a hurdle today. You know, you are, I'm sure you struggled with that, but you dealt with it. So I just want to compliment you.
Was that something you tried to do today? Was that something you put your mind to?
Well, this morning I was walking around and yeah, I noticed that the house was really messy to me. And so I basically just left. I left my room the way it was, and I left everything the way it was, because I knew that if I stayed, I would just start cleaning.
I'm really sorry you have to go through this, honey. I really am. It sucks. I know it does for you a lot. And I'm just sorry you have that stinking bully brain. I love you so much.
Do you want me to give you a second?
Yeah, no, it's fine.
No.
I love her too, and I want to thank her for being my biggest advocate.
I have to tell you, you are way stronger at 14 than I was at 22.
Thank you.
I truly mean that.
Thank you.
I'm Ife Chuatilu, and you're listening to Now or Never.
And I'm Trevor Dineen. And today's episode is all about obsessive-compulsive disorder. It's something that I've lived with since I was 21 years old. And today, for the first time, I'm talking publicly about it and what it's like to live with OCD and what I've done to manage it over the years.
Hello. Hey.
Hello.
Hi, son.
Hello.
How are you? Hi.
Hi.
Mm-hmm.
Hi.
Good.
How are
you
doing?
Good, good. How about you?
Hey, son. Hey, Pops. It amazed me when I was talking to the O'Connors about how much it reminded me of my parents and exactly what they did and what they struggled with when I was going through the worst parts of my OCD. My parents had a front row seat, and even though we're very close, it's just one thing that we never talked about over the years until now.
All right.
So you guys probably know I'm doing a little bit of an episode on my OCD and mental health.
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah. I do. I remember it. Yes.
What do you remember from then?
I said I wasn't going to cry.
This is the first question. You can't start crying at the first question.
I know, but I'm just thinking I remember how difficult it was. How difficult it was. And it was just, it was devastating. As a parent, you know, you will do anything. You'll do anything for your kids. And so it was, I didn't want to cry. So we sought out to try and find answers for you. And your dad and I, we looked and we looked and we looked. We started hunting around, and there wasn't much out there at that time. Our family doctors really weren't much help. I would talk to people, and I always found that there was a lot of people back then didn't like to talk about things, but it's amazing when you talk to other people how they know somebody who they... Everybody wants to sort of tell those stories, right? So somebody put me on to Dr. Willows, who was supposedly the best one in this field at this time. But I thought, okay, this was it. We were going to call and we were going to get you help. But unfortunately, the answer from the doctor's office was, well, I'm sorry, we can't see him for at least 2 or 3 or 4 months. And I was devastated. I was crying. I said, he can't wait that long. He needs it now. No, I'm sorry. They were not going to change their mind. So I remember days crying and crying. And I know a lot of people won't, you know, maybe don't believe in certain things, but I do. I believe it was a miracle. Because I just kept praying. I know you can't give me the answer, but if you could just open a door for him that we can get help. I prayed every night. And it was like 2 weeks later, we get a phone call from Dr. Willow's office. Yeah, they can see you. And that was the beginning. That was the beginning of the end. And that was, to me, a miracle happened. And then you went to start seeing him. And within weeks, you were so much better. You were the young man that we always knew, you know. And he helped you. He gave you your life back.
Oh, 100%. Mm-hmm. It was ridiculous. What do you remember, Dad, from that time? Like, I don't think you and I ever really talked a lot about it, like, over the years and even back then. It's like, what do you remember as you're watching your son?
I just remember the anger. I was so, so mad.
At me?
At how it was turning out that here's my son, that he couldn't do anything without going around in circles. It was like, someday something's got to happen here. And I knew I was just getting, all I was doing was just getting more and more angry. And it wasn't at you, it was just that what was going to happen to you? You know, what were we going to be able to do for you? And between Mom and I going out and trying to find people, taking you, driving you all over the place, wherever we had to go, those were the things that we just had to do. Whereas Mom is the emotional one, I was just the angry one.
You know, I'd sit in the kitchen and you'd open the cupboard door and I could see you counting up and down, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 1, 2, 3, 4, and I would be like, okay, or I'd go downstairs. And I remember a few mornings trying to say, come on, you're going to be late for school or whatever you were doing. And I would go down and you were in the bathroom. And I remember one morning where you were washing your hands. And I grabbed you and I grabbed my arms around you and I said, stop. Well, I know. I mean, that was out of pure love to want you, but to stop. But of course, we learned that that was the very wrong thing to do, that the more we tried to stop you, the worse it would get, mm-hmm. the worse it would get. Watching our son deteriorate to the point that we knew if we didn't get you help, we were going to lose you. I knew that in my heart. That's why it was so important to find you help. So...
What was that?
Oh, just you were by far the strongest person I've ever in my whole life ever known to get through what you got through, because it was all you. You had to do it all. We couldn't do it for you. You had to do it, and you did, and turned out to be absolutely fantastic.
I never really thanked you guys.
You don't have to.
I know. But I do. Dad, you said that I was one of the strongest people for doing that, but your strength comes from somewhere. And mine came from you, too. So thank you, guys. Because without you guys, there would have been no finding Dr. Willows. There would be no getting through any of this stuff. I don't know where I would have been or what my life would have been like. So I'm just very blessed to have you two as my parents for helping me out through this. So thank you.
Our pleasure. Our pleasure entirely.
I mean, I appreciate what you're saying, but certainly a parent doesn't ever need thanks. Excuse me, I'm crying. A parent doesn't ever need thanks from their child. All that I ever needed was to see you grow up to be the man that you are, and to see you overcome it is just the greatest joy that we could ever have.
Did you guys think during this whole time when I was going through OCD that I'd turn out so handsome?
that's just a joke. What did you think happened to his dad?
I love you guys.
And we love you too.
We love you so much.
Love
so
you big time.
I'm most impressed that throughout your struggle with OCD, that your ego just stayed so much intact, and it seems to have grown.
I feel like my father laughed too hard, and my mother, when I said that, like, that is a joke. And he made certain to say that as well, too. So it's
always... I think they were ready to laugh.
I think so, too. I think that's why I said it, too.
This is Now or Never on CBC Radio 1. I'm Ife Chiwetelu. And today we've heard a lot about what it's like to be suffering with OCD and how important treatment is. So I want you to hear from a psychiatrist who is in the trenches right now of treating it. Dr. Robert Sellis is with the BC Children's Hospital. He's part of their OCD clinic, which only opened 6 years ago. It is the first pediatric OCD clinic in Canada. The same clinic that both Ev and Kylie, the two teenagers we heard earlier, have spent time in. There are a lot of different takes on how to treat OCD, but the way this clinic works is they ask patients to push back against their compulsions and fears, basically lean into them. If something scares you, Dr. Sellis asks you to just do it.
I'm working with a young teen girl who, when she first came in, had difficulty going to school because of all the contamination, was sleeping on the couch with a pillow that she kept in a special place so that no one could touch it, was washing her hands constantly during the day, and really just struggling with a lot of these contamination fears. And so today we're going to go out and take on some exposures. Last week we brought some candies into the bathroom, the public bathroom, and ate them off the toilet seat. This week we'll probably head outside and hang out around some garbage bins. This is the thing about OCD treatment, is that when you start, you do things that it seems like anyone would be able to do. That you eat, you know, let's say a candy that someone else grabbed for you out of a bowl. Okay, most people can probably do that. But for treatment to really work, at the end, you have to be challenging them to do things that most people wouldn't do. First of all, anything we ask kids to do, we are willing to do ourselves. I have eaten far too many candies off toilet seats than most people would like to know about. Second, the amount of disruption and distress and harm that OCD causes in people's life is so far and beyond the infinitesimal risk that they get from eating the candy off the toilet seat. But if you just tell them the odds of that, if you just say, oh, the odds of touching a door handle and getting a disease is 0.0001, let's say, that doesn't mean anything to them. It has to be through experience of doing things that they build this new relationship and overcome that fear. I feel proud for the kids themselves, because ultimately the treatment is all about them facing their own distress. What we're getting these kids to do is every time they have a scary thought or something that they're afraid of, we're asking them to face it, to turn into it rather than to turn away.
Dr. Robert Sellis isn't the only psychiatrist we spoke to at the BC Children's Hospital. For more stories about the kinds of very unique and creative treatments these psychiatrists push themselves to come up with to help their patients with OCD, head to our website, cbc.ca/now or never.
My name is Julie Mason. I'm a 27-year-old woman living in Guelph, Ontario, and I'm currently in my apartment's bathroom. I'm holding a razor in my hand. It's an electric razor, and I'm just getting ready to shave my head. And it's vibrating in my hand, and there's kind of no turning back now.
Julie's hair is already pretty short. She calls her look G.I. Jane, but it has bald spots all over, especially right on top. Those are the spots where Julie has pulled her own hair out.
And that's what I call myself, is a hair puller. I live with a mental illness that's called trichotillomania, and that is obsessive and compulsive hair pulling, where the person actually pulls their hair out and they don't really have any control over it. That is one of a range of illnesses under the bracket of body-focused repetitive behaviors. And that also includes skin picking and cheek biting and nail biting. I've had this since I was 15. So I'm going on 12 years now as an obsessive compulsive hair puller. So I'm actually looking forward to having my head shaved. I can see a couple of more red patches from where I've been picking at my scalp. It takes a lot out of me every day to be my normal, regular, bald, patchy, scabby, sometimes, self. But I do it. If you'd asked me when I was 15, even 27 years ago, there is no way that I would ever consider letting anyone know that this is what I do every few weeks. There's no way.
I reached out to Julie because I was drawn to someone who has a compulsion that manifests itself in such a physical way that's hard to hide, as well as wanting to learn more about her journey from being a secret hair puller to being very open about it. It was a really great and insightful conversation that I hope you check out. It's on our website at cbc.ca/now or never. Trevor, we're almost at the end of this very personal OCD episode. How are you holding up? You're still standing.
I'm still standing. It's good. It's been interesting going through and learning so much and sharing so much as well. I think one of the names that's come up throughout the program, though, that you've heard a few times is Dr. Jim Willows.
Yes, the man, the myth. The one who helped you through your darkest times.
He truly did. It's unbelievable what this man did for me. He was my psychiatrist, and he works out of Seven Oaks Hospital in Winnipeg. I haven't seen him in over a decade.
Hey there.
Good to see you.
Good to see you as well, too. It's so weird just even being back sitting out there again. It's been so long.
And I realized there were some things I still needed to say to him, so I went and found him.
You always told me that there'd be bouts in your life where things would come back, and it happened to me many times. Two things kind of stuck with me. One was a diagram you did for me one day. It was basically a straight line. You said, this is a river with ice on it. And you said, you're here. And the first time you came, you fell through this hole, and you went all the way down to the bottom. And then we worked hard to get you back up to the top. And he goes, and throughout the rest of your life, you're going to have many, many holes. And every time you fall in, just realize you're not going to fall down as far, and you're going to be able to swim up a lot quicker. And that always stuck with me. I really enjoyed that. I think it's helped me get through a lot of different times, knowing that I could get back up quicker.
And that's very important for people, because the other thing that happens with people is they get treatment, and then they go, wow, I'm getting better. And then something happens in their life, they're going through stress or a very difficult time in their life, and some of their symptoms come back. And it can be overwhelming because you think, I thought I liked this. But it's not the same, mm-hmm. because you have these skills that you you have them. You just haven't used them for a while. And it usually is easier the second time because you have these skills.
One of the reasons why I really wanted to do this episode on OCD was to raise awareness, but as well how this life that I've kind of have now, like a wife and a son and a job that I love, I don't think any of that would have been possible if I hadn't met you. Not enough times in life you get a chance to say thank you to the person that did so much to basically save you. Like you pulled me up from like a time where I was completely drowning, and you brought me back to the shore. And I just wanted to say I appreciate it, and I should have been sending you more Christmas cards. I feel bad about that.
Well, thank you. Don't feel bad about not sending Christmas cards. I think this is great that your example it can be given to other people. 22-year-old guy shows up at his doctor's office, completely debilitated. He works hard. Now, 15, 16 years later, you're working for the CBC interviewing that same doctor. Mm-hmm. You know, I when you ask, is there a message of hope? Your story is a message of hope. You talked about wanting to kill yourself. You were completely debilitated. Now, you still have some symptoms, but we're talking about it sort of in retrospect.
Completely.
You know, and I think society would view you as a success, married, child, good job. Mm-hmm. That's a good message of hope for people.
I think so, too. Hey, thank you again for taking the time to talk today. I really appreciate it. It was good to come back here and see you.
My pleasure. My pleasure.
How'd that feel to be able to say that to him?
I think you kind of hear it there in my voice. It was great. It was needed. That's what it was. And thank you to everyone who we talked to, who shared their personal stories. I have to tell you, Ify, some of the best advice I got on this episode, because I'll be honest, it wasn't always easy going back and revisiting some of these things and meeting some of these people. And there's been a lot more emotion to it than I even realized there was going to be. But it was advice you gave me right near the beginning when I wasn't certain whether I could do this or not. You said if just one person is able to listen to this episode and it helps them, if it makes it better in any way, shape, or form, then the whole thing's worth it. And I just kept thinking that the whole way through, so thank you.
But I think you did that. And it has been such a privilege to see you muster through it, even the emotional moments. I think you are that much stronger for sharing all of it. And I do think that someone somewhere needed to hear part of this episode today. And if you are struggling with OCD or know someone who is, we have a list of resources on our website at cbc.ca/now or never. If you need someone to talk to right now, 211 is a great place to start. It's a helpline that's active in all provinces and can point you to supports that are in your community. Thanks to Don Matheson in Guelph, Ann Penman in Vancouver, AC Rowe, Sarah Tate, Anna Lazowski, Kai Hassarese, Sarah Atnikov, Iris Uday, and I'd like to say a very special thank you to you, Trevor Dineen.
Thank you.